All these happy faces. Listen, I don't want to hear about it. I think it's 5:30 in the morning, so I'm on Phoenix time still, so give me a little break. Can everybody hear me? Okay, no problems. All right. I want to start by talking about some very, very hard truths right now. The economy may be in a dumpster out back. However, it doesn't matter if you're graduating this year, next year, or 2012. It doesn't matter. You are in the midst of the biggest candidate-driven market emergency medicine has ever seen. Now, there are approximately 5 jobs for every resident graduating in 2010. But, and this is a very important but, are they good jobs? This is the question you're going to be asking yourselves. The problem is, you're the only person who can decide whether or not that job that you're looking at is a good job. You're the only one who can answer that question. Now, you're going to have offers thrown at you that are going to boggle your mind. They're going to make you nuts. You're going to be drooling out of one side of your mouth while you're trying to scream outside of the other. This market is insane. I am warning you now. How many have already gotten calls from recruiters? Okay. Now, why do we have such a frenzied market? Let's look at the contributing factors. Number one, the primary care specialties are losing residents like rats from a sinking ship. Less family practitioners and internists to the public means that the public is using the ED more often as a source for primary care. And if that happens, that means census is going up. There aren't enough emergency departments to fill the needs of the public. And there aren't enough emergency physicians to fill the departments. That's not a prediction. That is what is going on right now. So, another factor. Between 2007 and this year, 22%, listen to that, 22% of the labor force in emergency medicine either stepped down to part-time, went to urgent care, or retired altogether. That's one-fifth. And you're only putting out between 1,350 and 1,375 residents a year. That's not enough. Finally, the real estate market. Now, you wouldn't think that would have an impact, but think about it. How many of you have a house to sell before you move, before you take a job? Okay. Let's say you're a boarded residency trained emergency physician living in Florida. Do you know how long it's going to take you to sell your house? 1 year and 3 months to 1 year and 9 months. If you've got a house to sell, I suggest you get it on the market now, because it could take as much as a year to get that house sold. That's why the boarded experience docs aren't out there taking advantage of the candidate-driven market. They can't sell their homes. And even if they could sell their house, they're going to have to take a major loss on it. So you've got a whole faction of the candidate pool that is no longer a factor because they can't move unless their group loses a contract. For some reason, their hospital closes, whatever. Only by dire necessity are most physicians out there in the job market. Now, there used to be a situation, the average statistic was, that an emergency physician made 6 job changes in a career. And with an average emergency physician career of 30 years, you guys are like the sports stars, you know, the football players. You only have so much time on the gridiron, and that's it. You're gone. You're out of there. But with 6 job changes in 30 years, that's, you know, like a job every 5 years. And the fact that you don't have that going on anymore is a real major drain in the candidate pool. So that leaves us with a unique situation. Some employers are so desperate, they will do anything, and I do mean anything, to attract a physician. What you're going to be seeing out there, if you haven't heard about it already, are large sign-on bonuses, offers of loan payback, that's another biggie, as well as some really strange perks. Now, when I do my research for the September and October issue, which is the marketplace for this coming season, I literally find out about every single job available in the United States. And let me tell you, I have seen some really strange stuff out there. Take a job, get a house. I'm not kidding. Now, you have to figure some of these are coming from possibly some rural areas. You know, it takes a village to hire a position. But they're out there. Exotic vacations. There was one that was offering dates with a really hot nurse. Unfortunately, due to the fact that some people started complaining and saying the fact that that was not really recruitment, it was more like pandering, and using the hospital as a pimp probably wasn't the best public relations move. They had to cancel that particular one, but that did exist at one point. Now, there are some things that you need to think about before allowing yourself to be sucked in by a big sign-on bonus or even a hot nurse. These are things that are really important to you. What will the job that you take do to your emotional well-being as an emergency physician? How will it affect your overall career? And how could it potentially place you at risk? Because once you've spent a sign-on bonus, and trust me, those kinds of funds go really, really fast, what are you left with? The job. Somebody hands you a $30,000 sign-on bonus, I guarantee you, if you take that bonus in October, it will be gone by March. And what are you left with? A job that you got to start in July. If you go for loan payback, understand that you are signing on for as many as 4 to 5 years with that client, with that hospital, with that group, in order to reap the payback, because they're not going to give you $150,000 to work for 1 year. They may give you $30,000 a year over a 5-year period, but you're going to have to pay back. And in some cases, they're going to want 2 years for every 25 or 30 grand they're giving you in loan payback. So, I mean, you could be signing your life away. You need to be aware of this. And that is a very long time. Now, I want to be especially blunt with you. I don't care if you're living in paradise, if you are surrounded by all your favorite members of your family, if you're being handed $40,000 just to sign on the dotted line, there is one fact that is indisputable. Indisputable. And that brings us to our audience participation part. This is so exciting. Everybody stand up. Up, up, up. Stretch. Do all that. Now you are going to repeat after me. If my job sucks, if my job sucks, my life will suck too. My life will suck too. Let's do it once more. Like there's a lot of feeling. Give it drama. If my job sucks, my life will suck too. That is the end of our audience participation. You were excellent. Thank you very much. Now, what is the point of this little exercise? Don't make the mistake of taking a lousy or marginal position for a bribe. Because what else is a sign-on bonus? What is it? It's a bribe to take one job as opposed to taking another one. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't accept a sign-on bonus. What I'm saying is it should not be the reason you take a job. You take a job because it's the right job, not because they're handing you a check to begin with. This is nothing more than a very short-lived perk. Once again, what you are left with is the job. And if you are unhappy at work, you are going to be unhappy at home. And if you're unhappy at home, your family is going to be unhappy at home. And on down the line, including your pets. Imagine A really pissed off parrot with a very extensive vocabulary. All right, this is what you are potentially doing to your loved ones. A lousy job affects everyone you know, and it affects every patient that you touch. And that's a very important point. Now, loan payback. Only those employers in really, really rural areas and other hard-to-recruit situations offer loan payback. At least that's the way it used to be. I mean, I used to get loan payback in Caribou, Maine. Caribou, Maine is a place where there are more moose than there are people. There were three moose for every person. This is the kind of place where you used to get loan payback. Not anymore. With the candidate-driven market, more and more hospitals are using loan payback as a way to attract graduating physicians. Now, some of the best dog and pony shows will offer this banana. What you should say to yourself is, all right, if you've got an employer who's looking at you and they're offering you loan payback, the big red flag in your head should be why. Why are they so desperate that they have to offer loan payback as a perk to get a physician? Now, I work with a really, really great group in Cleveland. They're probably one of the few Democratic groups left in the entire Northeast Ohio area. One of their physicians got hit with a double whammy. Well, actually, the group did. One of their docs had to leave and go to South Carolina for family reasons, and another one of their physicians got pregnant and is having, like, hormonal psychosis kinds of things, and she can't work. So they are in desperate need of a doc. And they are just, I mean, they'll do anything because they really need to fill these shifts, so they are offering loan payback to someone who comes on a full-time basis. This is a legitimate reason for offering that kind of perk. And another situation would be, I did this lecture in Toledo 2 months ago, and just before the lecture started, one of the residents came up to me and said, I have to tell you, Premier Healthcare just offered me a sign-on bonus of $100,000 if I would take a job in Lima, Ohio, which says a whole lot to me about Lima, Ohio. Probably not number one on your, yeah, let's really go there and live list. Sorry, no, okay, you know, all right. But what I'm saying here is the bulk of this graduating class is going to be hit with all sorts of craziness, and you need to be able to sift through it. It seemed to me last year that the entire graduating class was headed to Texas because that's the legend of where the money is. Well, it's also where all the national contract groups are. It's where there is a high incidence of malpractice suits, and it's where some pretty dismal, barren countryside is. Have you ever driven through the western portion of Texas? Not pretty. Okay. There are high dollars, but a lot of them come with high risk and low quality practice profiles. You need to be aware of this. There is no land of milk and honey where cash flows like sap from a tree. It does not exist. In fact, I know of a few jobs in Wisconsin that are paying more than jobs in Texas. I also know of a lot of jobs across the country that are paying a lot less, but the cost of living is also less, and they're better jobs. So while you're evaluating opportunity, it can't be all about money. It has to be about the job. The point is, find out why the employer is having enough problems attracting good physicians that they have to offer strange perks like loan paybacks, really high sign-on bonuses. And you can ask this question. It's a legitimate question. I am aware that this is a very rare perk. Why are you offering it? And you are entitled to an answer to that question. If the employer has a good reason, like, for instance, this group in Ohio, then by all means, pursue it. There's no question, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're doing it and the specs on the job are iffy, you know, you're hearing about coverage, it's like, the backup is kind of, these are things you want to keep in mind. It may sound good up front, but that doesn't mean it's going to last for a very long time. So use your head, not your wallet, when you're job searching and to look for good opportunity. Now, again, I'm not saying that you shouldn't look for the best compensation you can find. Absolutely, you should do that. But I'm saying the current market, more than any of the others in the past, will be the most difficult for you to separate real opportunity for basically what is just highly polished crap. Now, when you are in high demand as candidates, which you all are, you are going to have to set your bullshit meters, excuse my vernacular, at, you know, high, just like the terrorism threat. You're in zone red now, guys, because you are going to hear about stuff you will not believe. This is the one time where you have to, without question, have specific goal setting and informed job searching. Otherwise, you're just going to get sucked in by the machine. So, let's talk about setting goals. Get ready to take some notes. Set your goals in the following three categories. Number one, position profile. First category, position profile. Second category, geographics and lifestyle. And then category three, finance. Write them down. It is not a goal unless it's written down. Then, number one, choose which of these is most important to you. Of the three, which is the most important to you? Whichever one you choose as your primary goal, it will drive the other two. Now, if you choose practice profile as your first priority, how many of you think you're going to do that? Yeah, that's 10%. Less than 10% of graduating residents choose practice profile as their first priority. Whatever the job pays, wherever it is, that's where you're going to take it. That's what you're going to earn. Now, let's talk about examples of a practice profile-oriented search. The most obvious, of course, is academics. If your strongest interest is in teaching emergency medicine residents, you are pretty much confined to going with an emergency medicine residency program. But what if your idea of your priority is a specific area of research? You've got to find a place that either already has a research program going in that or has the ability to help you get some sort of grant to start that research project. And this is a whole area of academics which, you know, most people don't get involved with. Bench research is very, very rare, and there are a lot of programs doing it, but there aren't a whole lot of physicians getting all excited and going into it. Now, maybe all you really want to do is teach, but you're not really interested in the research. There are academic positions that allow you to do the teaching that interests you, but don't require you to publish. These are usually referred to as clinical track positions. However, be warned, if you go with a clinical track position, it rarely leads to advancement up the professorship levels. You know, instructor, assistant professor, associate professor, professor. You need to publish to matriculate up to professor. There are some programs, I think, for instance, down in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins, if you have not reached a certain publishing level by 5 years, they just fire you. That's it. I mean, it's publish or perish in a lot of these places. So if you're looking in academics, if that's something you think you might want to consider and you're really mostly interested in teaching, understand that there are certain programs that are not going to be able to give you what you're looking for. Now, perhaps your top priority is to pursue an administrative career. You'll need to concentrate on those practices where you can pursue training. It's not easy. Administration is a very complex area. And now with healthcare changes, it's going to get even more complex than it already is. So you need to be in an environment in a practice where training components for ED administration exist. Now, you know, that ideal small democratic private group may sound wonderful, but the chances are they're not going to have the ability to teach you administration. You have, you know, seven physicians covering a 28,000 volume. They just don't have the time. They don't have the man hours. They don't have the ability to mentor someone coming in. Now, one of the things, if that is your goal, that you might want to consider looking at is the larger regional, even some of the national contract groups that actually have administrative training programs in place and career tracks for talented physicians who show an aptitude for management. So if that's one of your goals, that's something you might want to consider. A practice-oriented job search is when one physician will take a position based primarily on the job itself, not where it is and not how much it pays. Now, if you choose dollars as your primary search factor, and there's nothing wrong with that, there are a lot of physicians who do. I believe there was once a popular film called Wall Street and a character called Gordon Gekko who said, greed is good. I'm not sure I agree with him, but the fact of the matter is greed can have you living in a swamp or a dismal dust bowl. You are going to have to be aware that even in this market, there are trade-offs. Great jobs, really great jobs with really great groups with long-term retention of physicians don't need to use money to lure physicians. They have other things. They will not stoop to buying a physician. Less than great jobs will. So you have to kind of give this a little bit of thought. Get your details before you sign on the dotted line. Understand, you're most likely not going to be living in paradise for a job that pays a whole lot of money. You don't need to use earnings, again, as a lure if you're trying to fill a job in Colorado or San Diego or New York City or Chicago. People want to live there, so they're not going to be holding out for the highest dollar they can get. There are also situations where you may encounter lower coverage so that the physicians are collecting more on a partnership participation because there's more to go around. I mean, these are things you need to be aware of. If the partners keep coverage down so that they're collecting more, that puts you at higher risk. So these are things you need to look at. Uncommonly high dollars almost always go hand in hand with uncommonly lower coverage and uncommonly higher risk. So be aware of it. Keep an eye out for it. Maybe you have a very high loan debt, or for some reason you just absolutely have to buy an airplane. Whatever your reason is for putting dollars as your number one factor, understand that there are potential trade-offs. Make sure you recognize desperation when you see it. If an employer is offering an inordinate amount of money over and above what the region would normally pay, you should have red flags going off all over your head. I just want you to understand the risk. It's really not cut and dry. There's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes. There's a lot of stuff going on under the carpet, and you have to dig to find out what it's all about. Just be aware when you're out there looking at a specific area. Let's say you're targeting the state of Alabama. Now, rural parts of Alabama are going to pay a whole lot less than, say, Huntsville or Birmingham. But get an idea of what that state normally pays emergency physicians. And if you see a job that's paying, you know, 45% more, find out why. Just really, really get the details. Now, speaking of risk, I assume you are all aware of the malpractice crisis. Anyone not aware of the malpractice crisis? You know, go back to high school now. You need to start all over again. I used to list the states that were considered in crisis. I don't do that anymore because it's everywhere. It's the whole bloody country that's in malpractice crisis. Some states are trying to do some tort reform. There are other states, however, like Florida, where their legislation passed a law about 5 years ago called the Three Strikes and You're Outlawed. If you get 3 malpractice judgments against you, you lose your license. And that means all of the high-risk specialists, like OBGYN, neurosurgeons, any high-risk specialists, including emergency physicians, are leaving Florida like crazy because they are at a much higher risk of being named in a malpractice suit and having their insurance company settle. That's a judgment, gang. And all of a sudden, you know, in 5 to 10 years, an OBGYN could be dealing with as many as 5 to 6 suits in a year. An emergency physician, almost impossible to go through 5 years without getting named at least 1 or 2 suits. This is important information. You need to know about it. So in Florida, in general, becoming a difficult state to practice medicine with any specialty. So it's something you need to know about. Now, before you set your yellow brick road in any direction, you need to check out the malpractice situation in the state or the states that you are targeting. There are actually states like Pennsylvania where there are virtually no companies. Like there's one company left in the state of Pennsylvania that's actually writing malpractice policies. So it's become impossible. Premiums have skyrocketed. I have seen groups where their malpractice premium for 7 physicians increased 800% overnight within the last couple of years. And that money is not coming from the hospital. That's coming from the group. So these are things you need to be aware of. A lot of the small, independent, one-site private groups, they're getting hit and slammed big time. So where they would normally be out hiring 2 or 3 docs this year to cover their rise in census, they can only afford to hire 1. You need to know what the situation is while you're out there. You need to know that there are actually states, again, Florida, where physicians are practicing without any malpractice insurance whatsoever. In the state of Florida, if you're willing to put a $250,000 bond in escrow, you can practice without a malpractice coverage of any kind. So my point is, do the research. Make sure you know what's going on the states that you're targeting, what the incidence of malpractice is, what the costs of the premiums are, and how it's affecting the practices in those states. You will also find that there is now a situation where a lot of these smaller groups are not offering tail coverage. They are telling you when you come in the door, if you want tail coverage, you're going to have to earn it, and you're going to have to earn it over a couple of years. So this is not the case everywhere, but every now and again, some of these small groups just don't have the wherewithal to put out for tail coverage for someone who's coming in. They're very, very aware of the statistics that still over 50% of graduating residents are going to leave their first job within 2 years. So they're not going to start paying tail coverage for someone who's only going to stick around until they get boarded. So be aware of that. You also need to realize that physician shortages in any specialty will eventually affect the emergency department. For instance, in Pennsylvania, and also now in Florida with their lovely 3 strikes and you're out legislation, they've been losing OBGYNs like crazy. What does that mean to you? Rumor has it that if you get pregnant in Philadelphia, you have to give birth in New Jersey because there are no OBs left in Philly. So if you take a job in Philadelphia, the chances are if some patient comes in crowning and ready to give birth, they're going to be giving birth in the emergency department. That puts you at risk, much higher risk. So these are things you need to know about. When you're interviewing in a practice that is in a high malpractice crisis position in a state that has some serious backup issues, you need to know how much OBG is going on in the emergency department. Because if you're not up on birth and babies, you could be at some pretty high risk. Now, primary care specialties, as I mentioned before, are losing residents like crazy, which means that the census is going up in the EDs. Just 2 months ago, I walked into my primary care physician's office with what was the worst pharyngeal bacterial and viral infection I have ever experienced, or I think anyone's ever experienced. Now, I walked into her office. There was an empty waiting room. And the gatekeeper behind the window said to me that my doctor was seeing patients back to back, and she just did not have time to see me that day. And she told me to go to the emergency room. I'm standing there looking like a train wreck, barely able to talk. And she said, go wait in the emergency room. Well, that's what I did. I went to the emergency room. And $456 later, I fired my doctor. I now have a new internist who is actually aligned with the emergency room I ended up going to that had a 30-minute guarantee of walk-in to physician. And I said, okay, this is the one for me. Signed up, I'm in. But this is the kind of thing that's going on everywhere. Primary care docs, particularly if it's after 5 o'clock on a weeknight, if it's on a weekend, it's all go to the emergency room. So know that the sections that are usually known as fast tracks or express care are going like this. And at the same time, the acute care sections are going like this. So this is happening everywhere. Now, how many of you are choosing geographics and lifestyle as their number one? Now, see, this is the norm. Most of you will be choosing the area where you want to work as your number one priority. Very important, you should have strong reasons for seeking employment in the area you focus on. Employers are looking for long-term commitment. That's what they want. They want someone who's going to stick around, not just for a year or two, but 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, like that. They want stability. They don't like turnover. Turnover costs them time and it costs them money. It costs a lot of money to replace a physician. So, many are also quite aware of that alarming statistic that graduating residents tend to leave within 2 years. So they're going to be looking for people who are both getting their boards and their act together and staying, not taking them to someone else. There is a trend that Democratic private groups, the small one-site private groups that are supposed to be the ideal, will not even interview graduating residents, because they do not want to take a chance of someone leaving within 1 to 2 years. So if you see an ad or you see a listing and you try to get in on it and they say, if you're a graduating resident, we won't interview, that's why. It's nothing against you. It's nothing against your program. They just will not risk losing a doc within 2 years. Now, if you insist on a specific location, you will have to settle for whatever job exists in that location. And they may not be the best jobs for you. They may not even provide a decent income for what your needs are going to be. Remember, a lousy job affects everyone. It affects you, it affects everyone in your family, and it affects every patient that you touch. Remember our little chant that we did with our audience participation. What I'm saying to you is, rather than settling for a lesser job, broaden your search area geographically. Go a little further out in the circle until you find something that's a better job and is much more suited to what your needs are going to be, not just now, but 2, 3, and 5 years down the road. Now, have any of you encountered mysterious just weird things going on in your home? Food missing from the refrigerator? Furniture moved? Maybe even heard voices? It's called a family. You know that person you occasionally sleep with? The little short people that are called children? Chances are, where you go, they go. So when you're setting up these goals, you can't forget about them. They've got to be involved in this whole process. It's part of the goal-setting process. I really, really encourage you to sit down as a family and make these decisions together. Now, to illustrate what I mean, I'm going to share with you one of the more famous tales from what is now known as the Cat's Vault of Job Searching. This was many years ago. A graduating resident married with two kids and a large dog goes on an interview in Columbus, Ohio. Wonderful job, wonderful group, great interview. I mean, this guy was just, oh, wow, this is heaven. I got to do this. So they loved him. He loved them. They made him an offer on the spot. He said, absolutely. They shook hands. He went back to the hotel to get his bag and then head for the airport. Before he left, he placed a call, left a message on machine at home. Just had a great interview in Columbus. I accepted the job. I'm getting on the plane. I'll be home later tonight. So he gets home, and the house is dark. He gets out of the cab. He walks in, goes through the house, goes out in the kitchen, and through the big kitchen picture window, he into the backyard. This is absolutely true. Chained to a tree. His wife, his two kids, and the large dog, plus a sign that said, hell no, we won't go. This is what happens when you don't include your family in your gold searching. So imagine the wonderful call he had to make to Columbus. Not pretty. I wouldn't like to see anybody in that situation. Always, always include the family in every step. I have had situations where I have dealt with candidates where I talked more to the spouse than I did to the candidate. It was like having a manager for a sports star. We kind of told, usually it's the women, it's the guys who let their wives do all of the work. And it was like, you know, we told them where to go, little automaton, wind them out, send them out on the interview, and, you know, that's it. Okay, this is the one you're taking. I don't want you to go that far, but make sure that everybody is involved. Now, your first job, in many ways, is your most important job. It lays the foundation for your entire career, and that's really important. Set your goals wisely. Use a career head, not a vacation head. Looking for a job in Colorado because you love to ski is not responsible job searching. That's vacation searching. And believe me, no employer is going to be impressed by someone who job searches with their time off as their first priority as opposed to their time on. This is what I want you to look for. Get ready to write these down. This is what you want. You want an environment that utilizes the skills you have worked so hard to develop. You want an environment that provides opportunity for growth in the skill areas you want to develop. You want an environment that has a peer group that is supportive. Does everyone know what a peer group is? Anyone not know what a peer group is? Great. Okay. Also one that has adequate backup. An environment that features strong leadership from a director with mentor-like qualities. An environment that has proven stability both financially and on a patient satisfaction basis. And one that provides competitive income for the region. Now, once you've mapped out your goals in the three categories, write them down. My preference is a two-prong approach, a must-have list and a like-to-have list. In your must-have list, all the things that absolutely must exist in a job offer for you to accept it. In your like-to-have list, all those things that would be really great, that would be cool. And every once in a while, while you're out there interviewing, you may end up making a few switches in those lists. But as long as you have those lists to work from, you have some criteria to work from. And it will help you guide yourself through this entire craziness. Now, finally with goal searching, the last thing you have to really think about is time frame. You need to set up a time frame for your search. Even with this new market, I highly, highly suggest that you shoot for securing a signed contract no later than the beginning of March. Now, there are a lot of chief residents, who end up kind of being left by the wayside. They're so busy doing their chief resident job that January or February comes around, they go, oh, shit, I forgot about me. Do not let that happen to you. Make sure you're out there doing what you need to do to take care of yourself. Now, we went almost 10 years without a spring marketplace. In 2007, the spring marketplace magically returned. We now have two marketplaces. We have the fall market that runs from September through just before the holidays. All the jobs opening, interviews, most signed before Christmas. Then it kind of lulls till like mid-January and starts all over again. And you have a spring market that runs from the end of January pretty much to the end of March. And they're usually different jobs. But let me make one thing very, very clear. Most employers believe that the best candidates go first. So they want to be out there in the market as early as possible getting the top candidates. So the job market that has the best opportunities available normally is the fall job market, which is why I really encourage you to get this process started now. They want to secure talent as soon as they can. You want to secure the best jobs as soon as you can. Your time frame needs to be based on the month that you want to use as your site interview month. Check out your rotations for the coming 5 to 6 months. Pick a month where you have the lightest workload prior to January of 2010. Plan on making that your main interview month. For example, let's say your best month for setting site interviews is the month of October. That means you want to do all your research, potential position selection, and telephone interviews by mid-September. Schedule your site interviews in October with a deadline for decision-making by December 1st. See, once people have made you an offer, you don't get a whole lot of time to say yes or no, not in a marketplace like this. And in this market, that time is bound to be shorter than normal. Normally, they will give you 3 to 4 weeks to make a decision. It's getting now closer to 2 weeks. So be prepared. Let's say you go on an interview in November and you tell the employer you're waiting till March to make a decision. Forget it. We're not waiting around for 4 months for you to decide what you're going to do. We've got 17 other candidates lined up here. This is a great job. So understand that, yes, it's a candidate-driven market. There's a lot out there, but there's still a lot of competition on the really good jobs. So set your time frames in such a way that you have a clear progression from job development, interview, offer, decision-making. Once you've set up your time frame, stick to it. If you start deviating from your time frame, you're going to be all over the place. You're going to be window shopping, and procrastination is a nasty thing to see. So try to stick to your time frame. Now, many of you will be relocating and going to states where you are not currently licensed. How many of you are looking in states that you're not currently licensed? Okay, you need to find out what the licensing procedure is in those states. There are states out there where the licensing procedure can take 6 to 9 months. If you want to start a job on July 1st, 2010, you best have a license in your pocket for that state, or you're not going to be starting anything. Florida, Texas, New Jersey, New York, 6 months or more. South Carolina is getting right up there. Even Georgia is getting right up there. Georgia has unique problems all into its own. It has something to do about weird goings on the medical board. There are something like 65 suits still pending against the medical board in Georgia. But just what I'm telling you is find out, and there's a great way to do this. There is a website called edphysician.com, and they have a section that lists the contact information for every medical board in every state in the country. What you want to do is get in touch, have them send you an application, and all of the information regarding how to license in that state. That is absolutely free. The only time you pay is when you submit an application. That's when they charge you licensing fees. But until then, you can get all the information for free. Now, does anyone have any questions at all on goal searching? Good. I'm very thorough today. All right, let's move on to selling yourself. Your CVs and your cover letters. Okay, let's talk about an oldie but a goodie. You only get one chance to make a first impression. Didn't you first hear that like in first grade? You know what? It's true. And it's still true. But for people like you, your first impression is going to be made on paper. And it's called your CV. All right, pull out your workbooks and turn to page 14. What's wrong with this picture? What's wrong with this CV? Anyone? I'll give you a hint. There's something missing.
She doesn't have her title.
Yeah. This is the most often seen error on graduating resident CVs. The MD or DO is missing by the name. I get CVs like this. I say, okay, they're looking for a janitorial job. Maybe they want to be secretaries. You work so hard to earn those two letters. Why would you leave them off your CV? It makes no sense at all. But it is the most often repeated error on CVs. Now, let's turn to the next page, page 15. What's wrong with this one? Anyone?
Contact information.
Aha! Give this guy a gold star. Smack in the middle of his forehead. He knows how to read a CV. Teeny tiny little letters for contact information. If you send a CV out, the idea is for someone to actually contact you. They can't do that if they can't read your phone number and they can't read your email address. Nothing less than 12-point font on a CV, ever. And I suggest that you put your phone number and your email address in bold so it is easily seen. Now, I enjoy rainbows just as much as everyone else. I get gray CVs and I get blue CVs. I even get pink CVs. I don't like any of them. No. They don't fax well, they don't copy well, and they look unprofessional. White bond paper. If you absolutely must assert your individuality, buff. We will accept buff, but that's it. Make sure that whatever kind of paper you use, it's easily readable, easily copied, and easily faxed. Now, on page 16 in your workbook is a good sample CV. Use it as a guide. Then on page 18 is the definitive article on how to create a strong CV. I know because I wrote it. I also teach the course on CV prep at Scientific Assembly, so if anybody wants a real fun, in-depth workshop, come to Boston and join in. We'll have a good time. Now, a lot of grads ask me what they should put on their CV in terms of an objective. Well, let's think about that. What is the objective of a graduating resident? Believe me, employers understand what your objective is. However, there are exceptions to every rule. If you have a very specific practice objective, and that means you won't accept a job unless this objective exists within the parameters of the job, then you can have an objective on your CV. Example, absolutely must have ultrasound bedside in the ED. Looking for a terrific clinical opportunity where I can utilize my certification in ultrasound in the ED. Simple. If you send that CV out and an employer sees that objective and they know that they can take care of it, fine, they'll bring you in. But if you send it out and an employer sees it and they don't have that, peep six. Objectives are limiting and you need to understand that. So if you put a lot of stuff in there and, you know, you're kind of canceling out potential as you go with your objective, understand that you are limiting yourself as to the kind of jobs that you will be able to interview on. Any prospective employer who cannot fulfill that element will deep six your CV. Objectives are limiting. It's okay to use them, but only if you're willing to accept those limitations. Now, a lot of residents leave out what I think is one of the most important sections of a CV, and that is the personal section. This is where you have an opportunity to present yourself as an individual. since they pretty much outlawed moonlighting, of course, everybody does it under, you know, assumed names and other kinds of interesting ways. Yeah, graduating residents tend to come out with a very similar kind of background. And you need to find a way to differentiate yourself from the pack. I had a candidate beat out 12 other people for a really wildly popular opportunity because he was a triathlete. And he put it on his CV. And it turns out that the director was a triathlete. Boom. Instantaneous. Job made. Another story from the vault. I worked with a grad about 6 years ago who put his golf handicap on his CV under his personal section. And it was a rather impressive golf handicap. And I just happened to be working with a group outside of Philly that was comprised of 9 golf fanatics. They had received, as is often the case, they're working with multiple recruiters, something like 30 CVs. They only got 2 from me. One had this golf handicap on it. Out of all the candidates, he was the first one they brought in. They interviewed him 3 hours in the ED and 4 hours on the golf course. He lived up to his handicap, and he got the job. What I'm telling you is, you never know what a prospective employer might zoom in on. But they're not going to zoom in on anything unless you give them something to pay attention to. List your family. A lot of employers are looking for young families. They think they're stable. They think, you know, they're going to come here, they're going to buy a house, they're going to stay forever. If you've got kids, list your kids. Feel free to put their names in. It'll make it easier. If you are married, put your spouse on your CV. Put your spouse's name on your CV. I am so sick of getting calls from clients going, what's the husband's name? What's the wife's name? So they can get their interview schedule together. Put it on the CV. Even more interesting, if they have a job, which most do, put their job. I am married to Jason, a mechanical engineer working for. It'll give them an idea of, hey, you know, I've got a brother who works over at this company who might be interested in this guy. These are the kinds of things that they want to see. Sports, interests, hobbies, any of that. Get it in a personal section. Always put your date of birth in a personal section. Hometowns, absolutely. If you've, you know, been born and raised in Racine, Wisconsin, and you're interviewing in Wisconsin, let them know you are a native-born son or daughter of Wisconsin. That's what they're looking for. They're looking for people with strong reasons for being in the area. Now, I will meet with each graduating resident for this year, people coming out in 2010, after the lecture. If you have your CVs with you, I'll go over them with you. We'll meet individually and kind of help you get started on this whole process. I could spend 3 hours on cover letters, maybe 4. But fortunately, we won't have to, because the best article ever written on cover letters is in your workbook on page 11. And I know that because I wrote this one, too. Read this article. This is really important. It is a step-by-step on cover letters. A terrific cover letter can open a lot of doors for you. Now, speaking of doors, let's talk about how you find the right ones to open. Finding opportunity. Where is the perfect job? What is the perfect job? There are no perfect jobs. I'm really sorry to tell you this, gang. There is no such thing as the perfect job. But there are jobs that are the best ones for you. And again, let me emphasize, if you allow yourself to be susceptible to all the Barnum and Bailey tactics of desperate employers, you will never find the job that is right for you. Dangling unusual dollars, either in sign-on bonuses or other forms, are a smokescreen. They're not an act of a reputable, quality employer who provides strong, competitive income along with a stable, quality work environment, which is what you want to be looking for. Use your head, not your wallet, to decide what constitutes good opportunity. All right, where do you find good opportunity? Let's start. Classified ads. Annals of Emergency Medicine, EM News, Emergency Physicians Monthly. Certainly classified ads are plentiful. They are out there by the truckload. There's something you need to understand. Ads go in as much as 3 months in advance. So, what does that mean? If an ad is being listed 3 months in advance, what are the chances that a lot of activity has already gone on that particular job opening? You will also find in a lot of classified ads very little information. And you might wonder why all ads are approximately the same size. Extra letters cost extra money. The average classified ad is 60 words. It's just, that's it in the industry. The standard cutoff is 60 words. Once you go over 60 words, you are paying for every word over 60 words. So that's why the average job listing is only 60 words. And, you know, try to encapsulate a description of an emergency physician job in 60 words. I dare you. I can't do it. I don't know many people who can, but they try. And they tend to use words like waving palm trees and, you know, crap like that. And you don't get any detail about the job. So the other thing that I have an issue with blind ads or with classified is blind ads. Does anyone know what a blind ad is? A blind ad is an ad where you have absolutely no idea who the employer is. You have a box number. You are expected to take your CV with all of your bona fides and send it to a post office box. My big question, what's the mystery? What are we trying to hide? It doesn't make any sense to me. And the other thing is, you need to protect your paperwork. You need to know where your CV is going. You need to know who's going to see it and what they're going to do with it. This is very, very important. I hate to tell you this, but there are some nefarious, nasty people out there who will take your CV and use it as a marketing tool. They will paper entire states, sending your CV to every hospital in that state as a marketing tool to get job orders. And most often, the way they get those CVs is with blind ads. I'm not going to say how many of the blind ads are fake, but I guarantee you a percentage that would scare the hell out of you are ads that are made up so that they are attractive and so that people will send their CV and you never hear a word back from them, but your CV is going everywhere. And a month later, you're going to get a call from a recruiter who says, I have a client who's interested in you. Huh? Who are you? Why are you calling me? I never sent you my CV. Oh, yes, you did. You answered one of our ads. Protect your paperwork. Never send your CV anywhere unless you know exactly where it's going, who's going to get it, and what they're going to do with it. All right. Word of mouth. You heard it through the grapevine. I have been doing this for 20 years. And the one thing that I have learned, never trust the grapevine. No. Particularly these days. I mean, it's running overtime. It's just insane, the rumors and stuff that you're hearing out there. You're going to see job openings cropping up on Facebook, Twitter. I mean, it's insane. They'll do anything. Do not pursue a job on Twitter. Trust me. No, not a good idea. Not even if Paula Abdul is trying to sell you a job on Twitter. No, just leave them alone. With the grapevine, if you hear of something, you go on a job interview, you come back, say, I just had the most amazing interview and da-da-da-da-da, that's fine. But if you're interested in it, get the details first before you send your CV. Make sure you know what you're looking at, what it's all about, and whether or not it's right for you. Now, here's another one from the vault. About 2 years ago, I heard from a physician who told me that she got her job because of two drunken physicians standing over a dead boar. Let me repeat that. Two drunken physicians standing over a dead boar. This is actually what happened. One of her colleagues went boar hunting with a friend, who also happened to be an emergency physician. He happened to know that she was avidly seeking a job in Mississippi. They drank, they talked, they shot a boar, they drank a little more, And the subject got around to this, hey, by the way, I got a friend who's looking for a job in Mississippi. Well, it turns out he worked in Mississippi and she got a job. I mean, there are elements of the grapevine that can work for you if you are in control. And those elements are the people that you know. Everyone you know from medical school, from residency, on your faculty, these are people you should be talking to. I am avidly seeking a really great position in Minnesota. Who do you know? There isn't an employer out there who is not going to be doubly excited about a candidate who has been referred to them over a candidate who answered an ad. So the grapevine can work for you as long as you're in control of it. Don't ignore all the people you know. And if you feel like, you know, I don't want to be beholden to people, forget it. Take your pride. Everybody, take your pride. Put it right here. Take all your pride, all your ego, put it right here. Stick it in your back pocket. This is no time to be proud. You want to make sure you end up in the best place. You will have time for payback. But make sure that you don't ignore that great, great element of people that you know to help put you in the right direction. My favorite route to opportunity is the internet. It's immediate. It's usually the most informative. And quite frankly, nothing is better for you in terms of seeking opportunity than going right to the net. Now, the last thing you want to do is go search engine. You've got a page in your book that will tell you the sites to go to, but I'm going to give you some right now so you know where to start. Number one, numero uno, king of the emergency physician job searching, edphysician.com. This is it. It can be one-stop shopping. Macy's times 10. Right now, no less than 1,500 emergency medicine jobs on edphysician.com. You're going to see a lot of jobs from agencies. You're going to see a lot of jobs from national contract groups, but you're also going to see a lot of jobs from individual employer. They are divided by state. You can choose what state and go right through all the listings. It tells you how many pages you're going to be going through. And what I really like about edphysician.com is it's freeform. That means that it is up to the employer to decide how much information is given. Now, I only advertise one place, and that's edphysician.com. You can always tell one of my job listings. It's four times longer than anybody else's because I am a detail freak. Now, there are people who will also list on edphysician.com who will put it in four sentences. Terrific job in St. Louis. Great backup. Low cost of living. Huh? My November column is going to be called Truth in Advertising. It shall be very entertaining, that I do promise you. Anyway, the good thing about edphysician.com is every time you go in there, the way the jobs come up, the listings, are scrambled. So you could go in at 2 o'clock on Monday, and one list of jobs will come up in order in the state of, say, Michigan. Then you'll go in 3 hours later, and that order is scrambled. So no one is, you know, coming up unless someone actually purchases the top of the page. With every state, when you go in and the same job appears at the top of that state's page, it's because that employer has paid a little extra so that job comes up every time right at the top. There are sections for administration. There are sections for locum. There are sections for hospital. I mean, it's just all very detailed, very broad, and a whole lot of opportunity for you to really get in there and find things. Also, it does have the section on the medical boards. Every contact piece of information that you need for contacting any state medical board. The other thing I like is Ralph Single, who is an emergency physician, owns this site, manages it, and operates it all on his own. That is his full-time job. Now, it used to be when he first started about 10 years ago, he wouldn't allow dollar figures. I had a long talk with Ralph, and he has finally relented in the last couple of years, and you will probably find more salary and income information on edphysician.com than just about any other site on the web. And sometimes, you know, it's important to know. Now, you're also going to see things like my favorite, significant sign-on bonus. Superlative sign-on bonus. Legendary sign-on bonus. I mean, it just goes on and on. Get details. Make phone calls. When you get on a site like edphysician.com, you have usually a website you can check on whoever is the employer. It could be an agency. And all you have to do is read the email address. All of the ads for Team Health say contact our www.teamhealth.com. Simple. Or you'll see the name of an agency or whatever. So you can pretty much tell who it is that's running the ad. The other thing is that every job listing on edphysician.com has a date, so you know how old the job is. And that's also very important, which we'll go to in a minute. Now, number two, EMRA and ASEP have gotten together with a large multi-specialty website and created something called Career Central. And you go through ASEP or EMRA, there are direct links to Career Central. And you have to choose up at the top ED physician jobs. And again, they will come up by state. Unfortunately, this website does things based on a template, so you're not always going to get as much information as you would on edphysician.com. They're also running around 450 to 500 jobs as opposed to 1,500. However, I have found a few employers who will advertise on EM Career Central, but not edphysician.com. So never let it be said that I didn't tell you all of the places to go. You will not find as many salary and specific earnings information as you will on edphysician.com, but I think you need to look at both places. Shorter on detail. It's also a lot more expensive to employers, which is, I think, one of the main reasons why it's not as big as ED Physician, and the fact that it's a template, so you're not always getting as much information on a free form as you would like. The other one that's important that you know about is the AAEM Job Bank. Go into the website, I think it's AAEM.org, and up on the top, towards the right-hand side, you'll see Job Bank. Just click on it. One of the things, you're not going to find a whole lot of volume here. Usually it's running around somewhere between 80 and 100 jobs. But one thing that you will be assured of is that anything that is listed under their featured and approved section means that that employer absolutely conforms to their tenets of what they consider to be optimal practice management. It's going to be democratic. It's going to be under the AAEM guidelines for practice management. There are situations, it's kind of half and half. Half of them want you to send your CV to AAEM, who will then send it to the employer. But the other half, we can send it direct to the employer. If you see something you're really interested in and you have to go through AAEM, you can trust that they're not going to do anything nasty with your paperwork. So go ahead and you can actually call AAEM and say, look, I'm really interested in this position, but it's got a box number. Can you give me the information and I will contact them directly, or tell me how long it's going to take for my paperwork to get there and who am I sending it to so I know when they call me. Feel free to follow up on that. Now, the secret to using the web as a job hunting source is to use it often. Get on a site like edphysician.com, like EM Career Central, at least once a week. New jobs are coming in every single day, and you need to be on top of it. You need to be checking it and going through it all the time. There are many, many, many other sites. They are all general physician sites, and you have to go through all of this machinations. You click on this one, and you click on this one, and when you finally get down to emergency medicine, they have maybe three jobs. Don't waste your time with generalist websites. You'll see a page on page 9 of your workbook has all of your reference listings for you, so you don't waste your time. It will tell you where the meat is. Now, professional recruiters. Who needs a recruiter? Many of you will if your search is fairly broad and you don't have the time to do the research and the canvassing on your own. Many of you, however, may not. On page 20 in your workbook, covers those of you who don't need a recruiter, who have a particularly narrow geographic search area that allows you to do your own research and your own marketing. And this article will tell you step by step how to go about the search process on your own. Now, if you decide to go with a professional recruiter, and notice I stress the word professional, you'll need to be able to differentiate between those recruiters who are professional and those who fall under the category of pond scum. And it really pains me to say it because I am a professional recruiter. 82 to 85% of my colleagues are pond scum. If you ever walk into the exhibit booths at Scientific Assembly, the oil running down the center aisles is coming from the used car salesman lined up behind some of those pond scum booths. And they are people who care a whole lot more about their fee than they do in your future. So I really wish that there was something that I could do about that, but there isn't. You're the ones who are going to have to be savvy enough to know the difference between the two. And the way you're going to do that is by reading the article on page 25 in your workbook. Yes, it will help you classify the recruiters you encounter and choose the best ones to establish relationship with if you decide you want to work with a recruiter. Now, if after reading all these articles and you're still really not sure if you need to use the services of a professional recruiter, call me. Tell me what your deal is. I will tell you whether or not you need somebody of my ilk or whether you can do it on your own, and I'll tell you how to go about it. I'll even flesh out even further what's on page 20. Now, big, big question. Does using a recruiter inhibit your chances of getting a job? Many, many people ask me this question, and the answer is no and yes. A recruiter is paid by an employer to find the best possible candidate for their job opening. The employer has already set aside the funds to pay a recruitment fee. That can range anywhere from $18,000 to $25,000. Someone out there is going to be paying somewhere in the neighborhood of $20,000 for the privilege of being able to hire you, which should tell you why they're going to be very, very specific about how long you're going to stay, what your ties to the community are, and whether or not you are the best person for their job. This is not a cheap prospect. They can be an issue. However, if an employer is faced with a choice between two equally qualified candidates, one that will cost them a fee and one that won't. But if you think about it, the chances of finding two physicians who are totally equal are very, very difficult. Yeah, they might be equal in terms of training, but they will never be equal in terms of people. As people, they will be very different. There are so many factors that define and separate emergency physician candidates. They're looking for the one that's best for them. So maybe one of the physician is going to stick around longer. One has greater ties to the community. One has better interpersonal skills. The employer is going to be focusing on the long-term picture. So they're going to be choosing the person who is the best for them, who's going to stick around the longest. They're going to make their choice based on their factors, not on a one-time payment of a fee that they've already put aside and agreed to pay. So it's a very, very, very rare occurrence that a candidate is negated because of a fee. In 19 years, it has happened to me twice. And one of the two, the candidate that the group hired left in 6 months without notice, and they ended up coming back to me and hiring from me. Anyway, so it's something you need to be aware of, but I would not be concerned. As I said, twice in 19 years, I don't think it's really an issue. The benefits you reap from working with a really, really good professional recruiter far outweigh the possibilities of losing a job because you were referred by a recruiter. Any questions on job sourcing? Hey, let's move on. We're going to get into interviewing skills now. I'm going to check my time. All right, we're doing good. Selecting and scheduling interviews. Now, before you start scheduling interviews, you need to first select the ones that you feel are the best options for you. Again, time is not on your side. You want to do as much research as possible beforehand, so you only visit those opportunities that are best suited to your needs. You know, you keep lining them up and setting them up and so forth and so on. Be picky. 4 to 6. That's a good number. 4 to 6. You don't make going on 12 and 13 interviews. That's insane. First of all, you're not going to find 12 or 13 jobs that you're going to be interested in. 4 to 6 is a really reasonable number. For some of you, it's going to be 1 to 3. But whatever it is, don't go crazy about it. Now, don't waste time. Be selective. The best way to begin is with a detailed telephone interview with the department director of any opportunity that you are considering. Now, the department director may not always be the hiring authority. There may be a group situation where there is a recruiting partner who will be your first contact. And you can do a telephone interview with that recruiting partner because they are part of the practice and know the ABCs of that practice. You do not want to go on a site interview based on a telephone interview with a hospital recruiter who doesn't even know where the ED is, much less what's going on there. So make sure you have an in-depth telephone interview before you set up a site interview. This is really, really important. The only possible exception is if the place is across the street and you can kind of wander over on your break, sit down and have several meetings over a cup of coffee. But anywhere that you have to travel to do a site interview, make sure you do a telephone interview first. Schedule a specific date and time for a telephone interview. Don't forget to establish who is to call whom. Otherwise, you're both sitting there like high school, you know, girls waiting for the guy to call. Make sure you know who's calling whom, what time, have a date. That way, you're not leaving messages and going back and forth and wasting a whole lot of time. Don't rush the interview process. It's very valuable to you, and there is a lot of validity to the concept of striking while the iron is hot. So before the phone call, compile all the information you have already gathered about the opportunity, either from a listing or from the recruiter or, you know, whatever you have compiled. You also have a whole lot of research opportunity available to you through the web. Every hospital has a website. Get on the hospital website. Get all the information about the hospital that you can. Make sure that you got the opportunity to make a list of stats and information before you talk to the hiring authority on the phone. You can actually go into a hospital website, get into the section on emergency medicine. In some cases, you can actually get the name of every emergency physician at that ED as well as their training background. So, I mean, there's a lot available to you, and you should make sure you avail yourself of that opportunity before you get on the phone. That way, you can develop a list of questions. Have them written down, have them ready, so that when you do the telephone interview and the hiring authority says to you, okay, what questions do you have? There they are. They're all listed. They're ready. You should also confirm and flesh out what information you do have and have your schedule handy, because if you like what you hear, and you've got a really good telephone interview going, you don't want to hang up the phone without having dates available to give that person. Otherwise, once again, getting two physicians on the phone together, particularly emergency medicine physicians, it should be a contact sport for the Olympics. It's almost impossible. So try to get everything done on that phone interview. Have your schedule handy so that you can give them 3 or 4 dates to choose from. Remember, you only have to bring you and maybe a spouse. They've got to gather all the troops together so that they're all available and can give you a really good, concise site interview. The purpose of a telephone interview is to gather details, all the details. The last thing you need is to arrive on a site interview and have what I call if I had only knowns. If I had only known you don't have adequate coverage, you don't do ultrasound in the ED, your partnership is $3 million in debt, all your nurses went out on strike last month. You know, these are things that can happen if you don't conduct a concise and very detailed telephone interview. Now, your list of questions begin with practice criteria and end with income. Do not ever start your questions with a dollar sign in front of them. The other one you don't want to start with is shifts. How many night shifts am I going to have to do? How many weekends? It sounds like you're far more interested in your time off than you are in your time on. So always start your list of questions with practice-oriented questions. And then finally at the end, all right, can we talk some about income? And make sure you get all the details that you need about that. You don't want to come off in a what's in it for me kind of personality. Look like you're a serious job hunter. Sound like you're a serious job hunter. Now, since many of you will be looking at private groups, how many of you are looking for a partnership? Interested in a partnership opportunity? Come on, come on, come on, come on. How many? Okay. Only one. Really? Very interesting. You need to find out what the concept of partnership means to you, because it's different in every single one. There are all sorts of different formulas, all sorts of different incarnations, so you need to define that for yourself. What does a democratic private group mean to you? With such a wide variety of models, you have to be aware that there are some groups who actually use the terminology but don't practice it. If you've got a group where one person or two people own the contract, it's not a democratic private group. Even if they are dispersing the profits, it is not a democratic private group. Partnership with profits is not the same as partnership with profits and a vote. That's what equal equity ownership is. It's a different animal altogether. If you're looking at something, it's your top priority, be prepared to get down and dirty when it comes to the details about what partnership means. Partnership means responsibility along with profits. When the malpractice premium increases 800% overnight, where's that money coming from? It's coming from the pockets of the partners. Responsibility. When somebody in the group has a climbing accident and they can't work for 6 months, who's filling in? The partners. If you have to hire a locum, who's paying for the locum? The partners. You need to be aware of what that means. There are potential pitfalls as well as profits when it comes to partnership deals. You need to be aware of what they are. Now, also, along with your workbook, you have a five-part series called Defining Partnership. I call it the Partnership Chronicles. You don't need to read them now, but there's something I want you to read, particularly if you are looking for some sort of partnership deal. And they will define for you what partnership means. Now, when I wrote this series, I interviewed Dr. Len Natowski, who is the president of the DFES group that runs the Christiania residency in Delaware. And he said to me something that I will never forget. I think it's one of the best quotes. Not everyone is cut out to be the owner of a candy store. It's a very important statement. Each of you needs to consider carefully when considering putting yourself up for a partnership or an ownership track. For the purposes of these series, I want to make it easier for you to define partnership, and we're going to go through the separate levels I came up with. Equity ownership, basically the ultimate. Equal ownership with every other physician in the group. Full vote, same amount of profits, same amount of responsibility. That's what equal equity ownership is. A limited liability partnership is basically one principal owner with the rest of the physicians having a small piece of the pie. And then non-equity partnership is basically one or a few persons who own the contract but distribute some of the profits. And they may provide a vote, they may not, on the running of the department. Read the series, find out what it's all about. Now, before striking out for a big slice of the pie, you need to really examine your personal practice style. Decide whether that sort of thing is right for you. Not everyone fits the ownership profile. You may be among the many physicians out there who are happy getting a nice income, doing their shifts, maybe getting into a committee or two and going home and leaving it at the hospital. There is nothing wrong with that. But if you really want to be out there, be a mover, shaker, be part of a partnership, be part of an ownership, go for the gusto, then you need to understand that there are responsibilities as well as risk. Now, these are the questions you want to ask if you are out there looking at potential partnerships. And they are, what specifically does partnership mean in terms of profits and in terms of voting rights? That's the question you need to ask. As a partner, what are the responsibilities, both fiscal and managerial? How is partnership earned and over what period of time? This is very important. How and how long does it take? Is there a buy-in? You are going to find more and more buy-ins out there on the market. If there is a buy-in, how was it determined? And how much is it? And how long do you have to pay it? Most buy-ins are spread out over as much as 2 to 3 years, and you barely feel them. Some are a little fatter, some are a little faster, but you need to know the details. If the physicians currently in the group have not been offered partnership, you want to know why. If there's a group of 12 physicians and 5 of them aren't partners, why not? How many physicians who've worked for the group in the last 5 years have not been offered partnership, and why? Get all your details. And probably the most important question, does the partnership have any outstanding loans? If you become a partner, are you absorbing debt? The partnership still owes $500,000 because they took the $1.4 million loan to get started, and you become a partner. Does that mean you are assuming responsibility for your share of that loan? You need to know. You need to ask. Now, if a group for some reason is unwilling to answer any of those questions, you need to ask why, because those are legitimate questions that any group should want to answer. So when you compile your list of questions for the phone interview with the hiring authority, and it's a private group, have those questions ready on your list. The last group of questions that I want you to ask are also very, very important, and they have to do with the history of the job. Why? Write this down. Why is the job open? Why is it open? How long has the job been open? Even if you have a date on edphysician.com, that may be the date that they rewrote the listing. You need to know how long the job's been open. Have they extended any offers? And if those offers were turned down, why were they turned down? History of the job, very important. The answers to those questions can tell you a whole lot about the job. About half the inventory you're going to see this season is left over from last season. They're just going to reword it and relist it. So you need to know the history of the job. Another important group questions that I want you to find out about is the employer's hiring procedure. You might want to jot these down as well. What is their time frame? When do they want a signed contract? How many site interviews will there be? Some will bring a physician in for 1 2-day interview. They'll expect you to bring a spouse or significant other. Sometimes, however, in academics, it's a 2-interview situation. They bring you in, they do a clinical interview, and then they'll bring you back with the spouse for a more social kind of interview. But you need to know before you get involved what exactly is going to be expected of you on the interview process. Will they be covering interview expenses? Don't assume that everybody's going to cover interview expenses. In New York City, they don't pay a dime unless you accept the job. It should be a privilege to interview in New York. Will they provide a sample contract at the interview? Will they give you a generic sample contract to consider? Also, will they be making multiple offers? And will there be a deadline for the response? I'll get into these last two, the multiple offer and deadline, a bit later. If you aren't sure what questions to ask, starting on page 5 in your workbook, a comprehensive list of practice profile criteria. Everything you might want to know about a job but didn't know to ask. There's one old adage that I also believe in. There is no such thing as a stupid question. Just the stupid person who didn't want to ask it. So, scheduling a site interview. Now, there are quite a few factors that need to be addressed when it comes to scheduling a site interview. Turn to page 41. Page 41 in your workbook. Make note of the statement at the bottom of the page. It is a shameless plug for my profession, and I admit it. However, it is also a very true statement. There is a lot of detail to cover when it comes to setting up a site interview. And if you are working with a recruiter, they will take care of all of that for you. Once all of your details have been confirmed, ask for a full itinerary before you go. Have them send you an itinerary, and it should include all the details on your travel, your accommodations, and your schedule for the interview. Most important, make sure the itinerary includes the names and the titles of everyone you are to meet and details on where you're supposed to meet them and when. Now, if you are interviewing with a contract group of any size, it is very, very important that you meet with representatives of the hospital as well as the group. Your itinerary should include an interview either with the hospital CEO or administrator. If it doesn't, you call the group and you insist on it. You must get the picture from the other side of the fence. What hospital administrators have to say is often quite different from what the group has to say. And I can't tell you how many times I have seen residents sign contracts in December only to find out in May that the group lost a contract. And they are back on the market again with 1 month to go. So you need to know what the hospital feels about the group. Are they stable? Are they in good standing? Is there any chance that contract may be put out to bid? Now, in general, meeting with a hospital administrator is a good way to go no matter where you're interviewing, even if it's a hospital employee. You want to know how the hospital administration treats the ED. Are they supportive? Are they making sure that the ED gets everything that they need? I also encourage you to interview with the ED nurse manager. You need to know how the physicians and the nurses work together. And again, you're going to get a totally different picture just talking to the doctors than you will if you talk to an ED nurse manager. So make sure all those people are involved in your site interview. All right, now, when it comes to actually conducting an effective site interview, there are some key points that I want to cover with you. Beginning with the proper interview attire. There are some who think that jeans and sneakers and various body piercings are the way to go on an interview. No. Not so much. Conservative business attire is the only acceptable attire on an interview. Now, make sure that if you are suited and tied, it doesn't smell like it's been in mothballs for the last 10 years. Freshen it up, take it to the dry cleaners. Also, comfortable shoes are a must. You are probably going to be touring the ED. You might even tour the whole damn hospital. And that means a whole lot of walking. You cannot concentrate if your feet hurt. So make sure you wear comfortable shoes. Remember, I said shoes, not sneakers. Sneakers are not shoes. They are sneakers. Comfortable shoes. Now, want another favorite little candidate story from the vault? Back in 1995, I sent a candidate to an interview in Alabama, and he showed up in a brown suit, wearing a brown shirt, brown tie, brown shoes, brown hair. He was Pakistani. He was brown. And he was sitting in a chair outside of the director's office, and it just so happened that he had a really bad head cold. His haircut was a little weird, so kind of one side of his head was kind of flat, and the other side was kind of poofed. And because of the head cold, he was breathing through his mouth, and, all right, inadvertently, there was a little bit of drool. Two of the attendings walk by. He stands up, introduces himself. They kind of do this. Go into the director's office and inform the director that there was a mental patient outside impersonating a physician. True story. So, first impressions and interview attire actually do make an impact. Pay a little attention and try to, broaden your color spectrum a little. Wear puce, whatever. Just don't, not all monochrome. Now, what do you bring with you to an interview? Any ideas? What do you bring with you to an interview?
You have to take the bone out of your nose.
Yes, take the bone out of your nose. Absolutely. What do you bring with you to an interview?
Business cards.
Huh? If you've got them, absolutely. The other thing, 2-3 copies of your CV. You are always going to end up meeting somebody. Oh, you know what? So-and-so is available. Why don't we bring you down there? They don't have a copy of your CV. You can always put one in. Also, a small pad or notebook for taking notes. You must take notes. It's very important. Because particularly if you're cramming 4 or 5 interviews into a 2 or 3 week period, you are going to forget what you heard where. I'm not saying you sit down and you write every word, but you want to be able to at least note the highlights. The other thing, letters of reference. If you can, come to the interview with your letters of reference in hand.
Is it a good idea to put the names, the contact information for
them? You can either bring the letters themselves or you can bring a list of references which has the names, the position, the location, and their contact information, including both phone number and email. The other thing you need to bring to a site interview, enthusiasm. The biggest mistake candidates make on interviews is not showing enthusiasm. Now, put yourself in an employer's place. You've spent an entire day with a candidate who barely cracks a smile, doesn't react in any way, kind of shakes his head. What are you going to think? You're going to think that person has no interest in your job whatsoever. You are also going to probably think that he is an absolute asshole that you have just wasted an entire day with. You must show your enthusiasm. They will be looking for it. I'm not saying bringing your pom-poms and doing a cheer and all that kind of nonsense. Don't go overboard. But you must react and show some enthusiasm. Now, most interviews will include some sort of social interaction. It could be a lunch. It could be a dinner. One of the grads, I had experienced a combination barbecue and Mormon prayer meeting. Of course, that was back in the days when you could still get a job in Utah. So it's been a while. But you don't know what they're going to have. And if you get an itinerary in advance, you will know what they've got scheduled for you. If you bring your spouse, if you bring your significant other, whatever social interaction kind of setup they have, that person will be included. You can also expect, particularly if they do a dinner with the partners, that they will bring their spouses as well. I did a series called What Directors Really Want, and it had to do with what directors were looking for in a job candidate. And I asked one director, actually I asked all of them, but one response was my favorite. What are you looking for from a candidate during a social part of an interview? And his answer was the ability to use silverware. When you think about it, that makes a certain amount of sense. Anyway, this is not an opportunity to let your hair down, order the most expensive thing on the menu, and sit there with a lobster bib tied around your neck. No one is impressive with a lobster bib tied around their neck. I don't care who you are. You look stupid. So understand this is their opportunity to get to know you and your interpersonal skills as much as it's your opportunity to get to know them. It's really, really important that if you bring a spouse, you make sure that your spouse gets involved in a social interview, particularly if they bring their spouses. You could be in a situation where you're in a small group where the docs play together as well as work together. You want to know about that, and you want to know that you're going to fit into whatever that equation is. Now, at the end of an interview, it's a good idea to state your interest level and your intentions. It is quite possible you could go on an interview, have it at the end, an exit interview where you are actually made an offer. maybe you won't. But it's important to let the employer know where you stand and what your time frame is. It's still a competitive marketplace. Even though there are four or five jobs out there for each and every one of you, the really hot jobs, there aren't so many. So, if you procrastinate, there's a whole list of docs standing now right behind you who are ready to go in and say yes. If you don't get an offer and you really, really want one, ask for it. Dr. Smith, I have given your opportunity a great deal of thought during the past 2 days, and I have come to the conclusion that this would be the ideal place for me to begin my career. What do I have to do to get an offer? Be prepared to state why you believe the opportunity is the best one for you and why you believe you're the best one for the opportunity. There's nothing wrong with being aggressive as long as you don't become obnoxious in the process. Now, in some cases, you may actually get the offer if you ask for it. In other cases, you will get information on how they are proceeding with their hiring process. But, you know, we're really, really interested in you, but I want to sit down with the partners, get their feedback. Can I get back to you in 2 to 3 days? That would be fine. Be prepared for that kind of response. But if you ask for an offer and the offer is what you're looking for, be prepared to jump on it because they're not going to wait around. Professional, not obnoxious. If they say, we've got 3 more candidates to interview, it's going to take a couple of weeks, don't be afraid to kind of follow up once a week, a little email, found an article I thought you might find interesting, make a phone call, just wanted to let you know. I've got an interview next week in Sheboygan, but I'm still highly, highly interested. Whatever, just keep your name in front of them once a week. You don't want to get in touch with them daily. I mean, just don't harass, but once a week, get your name in there. Nothing wrong with that. If 3 weeks go by and you haven't heard from these people, and there is absolutely no reason why you shouldn't have heard from these people, there is a very good chance you're not going to get an offer. Move on to the next one. Don't beat a dead horse. However, you should let that employer know that's exactly what you intend to do. Now, some people think of that as an ultimatum. We're not doing give me an offer or else. You know, that's not the key. However, you can pick up the phone or send an email and say, it's been a month since I met with you, and since I have not yet received an offer, I am assuming there is not a strong interest in me as a candidate. I want to thank you for the opportunity. You always, always, always want to thank someone for the opportunity to interview. But it seems in my best interest at this point to pursue other opportunities. Now, any decent employer is going to agree with you and say, yes, you're absolutely right, and really best of luck to you. Thanks for letting me know. Or they're going to give you a very good reason to hang in there for just a little while longer. My assistant director just had a baby. We haven't had a chance to have the faculty meeting that we wanted. Can you give us 4 more days and let us get back to you? That's the kind of thing that's going to happen. But, you know, unless you actually get in touch and communicate with these people, you're not going to know what's going on. And you need to do that. Communication is everything. Now, finally, references. I could do another 2 hours on references, but again, thankfully, I won't have to because everything you need to know about references begins on page 37 in your workbook. Aren't you glad you have this wonderful workbook? References are a vital tool in job searching. You cannot go on a job interview without your references. This 2-part series will carefully help you put good references together and put them to good use. One tip I will give you is start getting your references early. Employers appreciate candidates who come to an interview with reference letters or a list of references in hand. In some cases, they will ask you for your references before you even interview. So you need to find out, well, as graduating reps, you're going to use the chairman of the department, you're going to use the director of your program and one faculty member. Also, in here, they will tell you who else you want to use. You should probably go with no less than 5 references. So read that article because it'll give you some great tips. Now, what's the first thing you do getting home from an interview? Anybody, what's the first thing you do? You do not feed the fish. You go directly to a table and a chair and you sit down with an envelope, a nice piece of paper, and a pen. You do not use email. And you write a thank you letter to the hiring authority. It is your appreciation for their time, expense, and attention. And it is your opportunity to once again reiterate your interest in their position, assuming that you still have interest in their position. You want to include the names of a few of the people that you met. I really enjoyed talking to Dr. Tyler about the simulation program. Little things like that show that you're not just sending out a boilerplate thank you letter. You actually paid attention. Hey, you're really interested in this job. That's what a thank you letter is all about. Again, email is not appropriate. Spring for a stamp. A sample thank you letter is on your work in your workbook on page 42, and it is a very good template to use. Okay, for any graduating resident, the toughest part of a job search, it can be the decision-making process, particularly if you are weighing multiple offers. So, you're the only one who can make the decision. But you want to make sure you're using the right criteria on that decision. Again, statistics, over 50% leave within the first 2 years. And that's predominantly because they took the wrong job to begin with. Now, I spoke with a 2008 grad recently who took a job in Florida based on large bonuses being paid out by the group. The bonus structure was based solely on RVU production. Everyone know what RVU production is? What he found when he got there was a slugfest for billing. Physicians were running into the fast track, grabbing 6, 7, 8 charts out of a bin, signing off on them, throwing the charts back, running back into the acute side, grabbing only patients that had potential for high billing, you know, knocking people out of the way, pushing patients through. He said he was scared to death, absolutely terrified. He'd never seen anything like it. That is something you need to be aware of. There are environments out there that are not encouraging quality. They're encouraging competition amongst the physicians and the group. If you are out there looking for incentive compensation, and you should be, because that is the best kind of compensation there is, the combination of guaranteed income plus incentive income based on the quality and the amount of work that you put in, make sure you are not getting into a situation where you are being put in competition with your colleagues. Make sure it's a formula for rewarding good work. Now, on page 28 in your workbook, you will find the series I did that I referred to called What's Negotiable, a result of many interviews with different employers from all over the country. It has some of the best advice I've ever heard on the subject and can provide you with some really strong guidelines. If you haven't read it, I highly encourage you to do so. Keep in mind, the market has changed quite a bit since I did this series, but the basic principles still apply. My best advice to you in this stage, in the decision-making stage, is to find yourself a good advisor, someone you can sit down with and go over every aspect of a job offer. If you choose someone on your faculty, it should be someone with experience and knowledge about the kind of practice you are looking at. A physician who has an academic background is not going to be the best person to advise you on a community hospital opportunity. Make sure you are comparing apples to apples, not apples to oranges. If you can't find someone on your faculty and you aren't working with a recruiter that you think will be really objective with you, since you sat here in this room and most of you did not fall asleep, you get the carte blanche to call me. I will go over your opportunities and your offers with you and help you make sense of them and come to a decision. No charge, no nothing. You went through it, I will go through it with you. You have that offer. Now, if you are considering a position in a national contract group, an MCARE, a Team Health, Schumacher, even CEP America, you may get some resistance from your faculty advisor because they still think that all national contract groups are the spawn of the devil. And in some cases, back in the old days, that was true. you looked at Coastal and Sterling, and there was an expose in 1994 on 60 Minutes on contract groups. And it focused on Coastal, Sterling, and one other whose name I have probably repressed. And I will never forget it. They showed a video of a doctor walking across a parking lot of a hospital in Florida. His name was Dr. Mangalapudi. Manga, as in mangle. He had the most sinister face I have ever seen on an individual in my life. He had also lost 7 state licenses from convictions on sexually assaulting patients. And here he was working for Coastal in Florida. I mean, it used to be really, really ugly out there, guys. Now, I will say that a lot of changes have happened in national contract groups. I did a lot of research. I did a couple of articles back in the early part of this century. And, yeah, there's still some real scum out there, but there are also some really good groups out there who have really, really put the effort into creating quality practices, even though they are so-called corporate medicine. They are taking real good care of their docs. They've got great administrative track records and even academic residency programs, all sorts of stuff going on. So what I'm saying to you is don't judge based on what one person's opinion is. Look at each potential opportunity and each potential position and evaluate on its merits that particular opportunity. Even as evil and horrible as Coastal was, Coastal had a contract in Asheville, North Carolina that was absolutely the picture of perfection. And you had to wait, literally, you had to wait for someone to die to even have a shot to get in there. So not, you know, just because a group on the whole may have a horrible reputation, that doesn't mean that every contract that they handle has a horrible reputation. So use your own head and get out there and look. That brings me to one other point. A couple of years ago, I got a call from a guy who just started a job with a regional group in Ohio. He just bought a house. They absolutely loved the house. They loved their neighborhood. He loved the people he was working with. He was the happiest guy in the world. But he was getting ready to go on a job hunt because someone in a very elite emergency medicine association told him that he was not being paid the appropriate dollar per patient chart average. Now you're going to hear a whole lot of numbers out there, and you're going to have a whole lot of people saying, this is what you should be looking for, this is the number that you should be looking for in these statistics, and basically, these are guidelines. These are not absolutes. There's no such thing as an absolute number you must earn in a specific region. They're guidelines. Don't be swayed by somebody who has a statistic from somewhere up in the stratosphere. Use your own judgment. Find out what the ranges are in the area where you're looking and make judgments based on that, not on somebody's idea of a pie chart. Every emergency department is different. They have a different patient mix. They have a different payer mix. They've got a different HMO penetration. A different acuity. You have to evaluate each job on that department's specific parameters. Again, ideal guidelines are good for a base, but they are not what you are to make your decision on. Deadlines. I told you we would get to deadlines. Most offers come with a deadline. Don't make the mistake of thinking that employers will sit and wait for you to make a decision. In some desperate areas of the country, they just might. But they're not going to wait forever. And if somebody else shows up and then that person is ready to say yes and they're qualified, they're going to jump on that person. So if you see a job that you really, really, really want, you do everything you can and they make you an offer, you jump on it. This is not high school. It is not time to play hard to get. If you find what you're looking for, jump on it. The multiple offer process. There are employers out there that will interview 5 to 6 candidates. And out of those 5 to 6 candidates, they will decide that 4 of them are eligible, are qualified, and would make good positions for their group. they will make offers to all four candidates. That's called a multiple offer scenario. Whoever accepts the job first gets the job. So that's why when you do your phone interviews, you want to know how that particular employer is going to make their decision. Are they going to make single offers to single candidates, or are they going to make multiple offers with kind of a race to whoever accepts first? It's nice to have comparisons, but you need to know that if you've done all your due diligence and you've found a job that you really want, you want to know how they're going to hire so that you've got your ducks in a row and you can get in there and get the job that you want. Now, many grads ask me how many job interviews they need to go on to make a decision. Anybody know the answer to that? Well, it's nice to have comparisons. But the truth is, if you find what you're looking for on the first interview, why continue to interview? It's like shoe shopping. You're looking for the perfect pair of crocodile pumps. You go into the first shoe store, and there they are, the perfect pair. They fit like a glove. The price is right. You buy them. Why would you go down the street and keep looking? All right, I'll admit some of you guys may not shop for crocodile pumps. On the other hand, maybe some of you do. Personally, I don't want to go there, okay? So we'll just leave that alone. But the point I'm trying to make is if you find what you're looking for, first gate, jump on it. Because the chances are you will not find anything equal or better out there. One of the hidden factors involved in decision-making is often ignored, and it's called a fear of change. It doesn't matter that, you know, you're moving from low pay, long hours, and maybe living in a hovel to high dollars in a penthouse. Many grads experience a reluctance to leave the comfort zone of the training regimen. It's usually a subconscious fear that goes unrecognized, but it's exhibited by hesitancy to make a decision. Fear is not limited to the physician. It can be felt by their families as well. This is not mental illness. It's the human condition. Change breeds indecision and fear, and it can be overwhelming to anyone. You're packing up. You're moving. You're going to a totally new location. You're making serious money for the first time in your life. You're going from an environment where you've got controlled learning, and you're going into that of a responsible practitioner. All of these factors are going to have an effect on you and yours. To avoid falling into the fear pit, all of you and your family members need to take steps now to prepare for change. On page 4 in your workbook is a lovely list of things that you will help, that will help you do just that, will help you psychologically prepare for change. Sit down, go over them with your family. They really work. This is based on not only my experience for 19 and 20 years, but some good psychologists who work in the area of fear of change. The final barometer for decision making is your gut. Listen to it. If your gut tells you that the job seems too good to be true, it probably is. If your gut tells you you don't have a full picture, you've got more questions to ask. Try to remember this isn't your only job. It's your first job. And while your first job is very important, it isn't the end of the road. So don't let yourself get too stressed out by the process. Make sure you pay attention, you do your due diligence, you set your goals, you do it with your family, and you go through a standard, reasonable progression. And stick to your time frame. Now, there's one other subject I want to hit before we get lunch, because we're, 10 minutes from lunch? Okay. And the subject is the ethics of job searching. This is a biggie. Emergency medicine is still a fairly small community. There are about 32,000 physicians in emergency medicine. They're practicing in now only about 4,800 EDs across the country. It used to be 5,500. That's what's happened to this to the specialty. Hospitals are closing, EDs are merging. It's really falling apart. But in some ways, it's just keep getting smaller and smaller, even though we're putting out more and more physicians. Remember that that 32,000 is made up of almost 15,000 that never went to an emergency medicine residency. They're just still out there working. They've been doing shift work even though they have internal medicine or a family practice or other kinds of backgrounds. So in terms of peer group, there's only about 20, maybe 22,000 docs out there that are peer group docs. My point is you're going to be meeting those people when you go out and you go out to interview. And you want to make sure that when you interview, people remember you in a good light because you never know when you're going to run into those people again. You want to accomplish this by behaving like a professional. When you turn a job down, do it politely. Give valid reasons why you are turning that job down. And always, always thank the person for the opportunity to interview. Always notify any employer you interview with. If you do a site interview with an employer, you are obligated to let that employer know what your final decision is, where you are going, because you are saying to them, I may not be accepting your job, but I think it is important enough that you spent the time and the expense with me that I let you know what I chose to do. And I absolutely defy any residency program to get out with their grads and track where they go. Residency programs should be checking and cross-checking the progress of their grads, what jobs they take, how long they last, and where they go from there. It's the only way we're going to have an idea of what's going on in the manpower in this industry. Anyway, that's just one of my bugaboos. Always send a thank you letter to the hiring authority. And when you say yes to an offer, make sure you mean it. You have given a verbal acceptance. You have given your word of honor. Some people think that it's not really an acceptance until you sign the contract. Think again. When you accept an offer verbally, that employer will stop interviewing. They will tell the other people in the pipeline that they have a candidate who has accepted their job. And if you renege on that acceptance, believe me, they will remember you and your name forever. The usual circumstances on this scenario are as follows. A candidate is waiting for an offer from an employer, but he doesn't want to lose out on job offer number two. He already gets that offer, so he accepts offer number two, and he stalls the contract until the other offer comes through. You cannot have your cake and eat it too. You must make a decision. This is unethical behavior, and it will come back and bite you in the ass someday. If you want offer number one, you cannot accept offer number two unless you are willing, ready, and able to go to offer number two. Here's another scenario. Candidate is hoping a job will come up with a certain facility. They contact that facility. They have a friend on the staff, whatever. And the friend tells her, there is not a chance in hell that we're going to be hiring this year. I'm really sorry. I wish we could. We are overly staffed. They go out. She goes out. She finds that really terrific job. She's made an offer. She accepts it. She signs the contract. A week later, she gets a call from her friend. You're not going to believe it. We just lost two docs. They were married. The mother-in-law is sick. They have to move to Texas. Can you come in for an interview next week? Candidate goes on the interview, gets the job, sends an email to the first employer that rescinds her acceptance due to personal reasons. Unacceptable, unethical. The only professional, the only ethical response when that call comes in from the friend, you're not going to believe what happened. Shit. I wish you'd called me 4 weeks ago. I just accepted a job and signed the contract. I'm really sorry. That is the only responsible, ethical response you can have. It is a fact. It is a fact that when candidates renege on offers, they've accepted, they always use email. You know why? Because they know what they're doing is unethical. And they don't have the guts to do it up front, in person, or on the phone. So they send an email. Directors talk to each other. When you screw them over, the word gets around. That's not the way you want to start your career. Yes means yes. You cannot hedge your bets. You must take responsibility for your actions and your choices. Now, I wrote a piece for this August in my column, and it's called Conduct Unbecoming an Emergency Physician. And it focuses on the deteriorating behavior of the physician candidates and the job market since it became a candidate-driven market in the past year. It's on page 53 in your workbook. The stories are from directors all over the country, and they are at best embarrassing and at worst nearly fraudulent in nature. I had directors beating down my door to have their tales of woe included in this column. And these are directors from really, really great groups and hospitals. There's no excuse for this kind of behavior. It's like looters doing during a hurricane. You are physicians. You took an oath to save lives. And I don't care if you think you took an oath to do what is best for me. That is not the case. Once again, you may be in the driver's seat, but that does not give you the right to run over people in the road. And that's all I'm going to say on ethics. Now I'm going to let them bring in lunch. And while you're eating, you will be the first people in all of emergency medicine to hear about the market for this year. I just finished the research, submitted the programs and the columns, and I will tell you everything there is to know about where the jobs are and how much they're paying, including all of the CAHPS top 10 lists. I couldn't distribute them because my publisher won't like me, but I will tell them to you so you can write them down. So go get some lunch.